It's Tuesday, February 16th. It's just a cold snap until everything breaks. We start here. Officials in Texas are scrambling as power, roads, even vaccine freezers go down.
So the trails are great, but all the bridges are like slides.
Amid once-in-a-generation weather systems, snow days have become emergencies in state after state. There are fewer COVID infections happening, which is leading to even more confusion.
It was 4 days after the mask mandate lifted. I had my first person walk in without a mask.
Some business owners are pleading with officials not to open up too soon. And President Biden says he wants to welcome asylum seekers into the U.S., so why are they still in Mexico?
A lot of these migrants are even seeing snow for the very first time.
Patience is a virtue until you're freezing to death. We'll walk you through the new crisis at the border. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
Where's my hat?
Depending on where you live, you might have noticed it's really, really cold. Which, whoop-de-doo, it's February.
I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. The next few days are going to be very tough.
But I'm not talking about a chilly breeze, and I'm not talking about a local weather system. I'm talking about a series of storms that has forced a large part of the country to basically stop everything it's doing, and that has forced local officials to change everything they thought they'd be doing during a pandemic.
This looks like a Midwestern city, but we are in downtown Dallas this morning. Temperatures in single digits, the wind chill making it feel like it's 11 below.
A truck losing control on a snowy highway in Toledo, Ohio. A pickup truck sliding out of control down a street in Nashville.
When a city in Massachusetts has a snowstorm, you send in the plows to clear the roads. But when it happens to most of Texas, what do you do?
When people were trying to turn in the left turn lanes, they were getting stuck because those parts of the road were just untreated.
Let's go to ABC's chief meteorologist, Ginger Z, this morning. Ginger, what are we seeing and how is it different from, you know, your normal ice storm?
I mean, this is an unbelievable map. When we say coast to coast, we're often skipping some states and we're like, well, some will be. No, almost every single state has some sort of winter weather alert.
Our bedroom measured at 42 degrees. So it's cold in our house.
And we are talking the snowiest day in Seattle history since 1969. They had almost 9 inches the other day.
Hey, my name is Kevin James. I'm here from San Antonio, and we got snow in front of the Alamo.
Then you talk about Texas, where Houston, Dallas saw their first wind chill warnings ever.
I thought I'd drain the pipes in the attic overnight so they wouldn't freeze, but came out this morning. And the supply line froze.
So the trails are great, but all the bridges are like slides.
Sub-zero wind chills in Texas for 48 hours.
There are rolling blackouts in Texas and at least 14 other states just to try to keep the power grids from failing to give heat to those who still have power.
And now we know millions of people without power all the way through the Mid-Atlantic because of ice.
And not only worse than usual, Ginger, but I got to imagine, like, if you're a city bureaucrat, like, literally the worst time in your tenure since you've had the job.
Right. And that's the thing is, you know, if you have the coldest air from Midland, Texas to Houston in more than 30 years, you're like, okay, that's significant.
A brief update on vaccines.
Until you take out the power, and the power was running a freezer where it had vaccines that were for people that needed them.
At that location, we had 8,430 Moderna vaccines. With the power out, we all know those vaccines need to be kept in cold storage. So we got to work.
And that's what we're talking about, is the implication for a winter storm goes beyond the person who slips and falls and dies, and beyond the carbon monoxide deaths that are happening, the pipes bursting, the power grid struggling. This is about life and death on a much broader scale.
It almost seems like it's a story just as much about weather, your beat, Ginger. It's also like an infrastructure story, right? Does it speak to like a certain vulnerability in cities and states? Where, like, I guess I'm thinking, like, no one cares about a 5.0 earthquake in Southern California, but if it happens in Manhattan, that's a big deal, right? same principle, I'd imagine, if you got a city or state that is just not prepared for the scope of this.
It does. And sometimes I wonder, you know, when Austin or Dallas's airport shut down, as they did yesterday, this is a once-in-a-decade event for a lot of places. Wouldn't it behoove them to have a plow or two to attach to the front of a truck? I don't know. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but that's why they shut down, because they don't have the equipment.
There are a number of generation plants that have been taken offline I like your wind turbines that are frozen over in various parts of the state. One of our nuclear plants had to be taken offline.
So the infrastructure questions go beyond what we have right now and the choices that have already been made, but also to what will we do in the future when we will inevitably see more polar and Arctic plunges and more extreme heat.
Wait, I was just about to ask you about climate change because I was going to say, isn't this the part where somebody asks you, hey, where's your global warming now, Ginger? Which I know it's silly because like the global trend lines are irrefutable, but I mean, doesn't it raise the point of why would you invest in cold weather infrastructure? Shouldn't we all just be preparing for warm weather stuff?
Right. So every time I post, like I did yesterday, 51 below in North Dakota, an all-time record for this town, then I inevitably have, and I can forecast this with 100% accuracy, dozens of people will write me and say, where's your global warming now? And I just want to make sure it's clear, extremes and fluctuations that are beyond even what we usually see are actually a symptom of climate changing.
We turn now to the Arctic. Just this week, the National Snow and Ice Data Center announced this year's Arctic sea ice shrank to the second lowest in recorded history. And it's not just polar bears that will suffer.
Last fall, we had the second lowest Arctic sea ice on record. And so you'd say, oh, okay, so that's warmer. Why are we seeing this extreme polar air? Well, what happens in a warming climate is that Arctic air gets trapped, you could say, and it will burst out. It will come down, and it can happen in longer periods of time, which is exactly what we're seeing right now. So in general, it is warmer than the polar blasts of the past, but by a degree or two. So even though it's not 60 below, it's 58 below. That is still warming.
How you doing, Mark?
Oh, trying to stay warm here. Yeah.
So if that makes sense, I actually was speaking with the state climatologist and the weather historian for the state of Minnesota.
You know, all our warmest years have been compiled in the last two decades, for crying out loud.
And he's been doing this for almost 45 years. And he was telling me that in his lifetime, compared to their 150 years of records, the rapidity of the change is the exact thing we should all be looking at.
Just because we have some negative excursions that last for a few days or maybe even like this one, 10, 11, 12 days, that doesn't negate the background long-term upward trajectory. In no way does it. And the more we look at the data, the more obvious that is.
How significant these ups and downs have been and how closely they're happening together. This points to climate change. So yes, cold can mean a warming climate.
Yeah, and Ginger Z here actually has an entire series on ABC News Live, our digital channel. The name of the series is It's Not Too Late. A lot of conversations to be had about climate change and where we go from here. Ginger, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Stay warm.
On one day in January this year, more than 300,000 cases of COVID-19 were reported. We had never seen anything like that number. Well, barely a month later, the U.S. is now down to under 100,000 cases a day. A two-thirds reduction in the world of viruses, that is a real quick drop-off.
While we're doing vaccines and while we're controlling the spread of COVID, we also have to, at the same time, get this economy open intelligently and in a balanced way.
As a result, you are seeing more and more states doing what lots of people have been begging for months. They're allowing indoor dining. Some are opening up live sporting events.
Hockey, basketball, football, soccer, baseball, music shows, performances, any large arena can open on February 23rd.
And as you'd expect, a lot of that pressure has come from business owners, the live event crew, the restaurant who is hemorrhaging cash in these temperatures. But not all business owners are happy about this. I want to take you to Iowa right now. Becky Pospisil is a business owner in Des Moines, Iowa. I see you there in your shop right now, Becky. What kind of place do you run?
I own a do-it-yourself studio where people can come in and make all kinds of projects.
Okay, so very like people are there, like people who work with their hands. Can you describe what it's been like in Des Moines over the last couple of months?
Yeah, Iowa's been very lax from the get-go about COVID policies. And we did kind of what the whole country did, shut down last year for several weeks and then reopened at diminished capacity and without a mask mandate the entire time.
If you look at some of the states and the timelines that they actually issued a mandate, they're
The cases are still rising. So, you know, it's just there's not a silver bullet. There's not a single answer. But we do.
So it was really up to shop owners to kind of set their own policies for how they're planning on handling COVID.
34 people died yesterday in Iowa from COVID, a single day record for that state.
We definitely saw lots of spikes. Towards November, it got very high.
In Iowa, the governor there is reversing course, now issuing a mask mandate.
And so there was a mask mandate that was put in place by our governor in November, and she just recently lifted that as of last week.
I'm not saying go out there and be carefree and not be responsible. I'm saying I trust Iowans to do the right thing, and I know our businesses will do the right thing too. They're doing it every day.
So we're kind of back to square one.
Have you seen changes then because of that?
When we had a mask mandate in Iowa, it was great because as a business owner, I didn't have to police it. It was something that was happening everywhere. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew about it. It was just kind of common knowledge and people complied. They really did. I didn't have any incidents of people walking in without a mask on. Since the governor has lifted the restriction as of last week, I've already had people walk into the shop without a mask. And when I ask them, do you have a mask? They tell me no.
Really? So you've come up against this all, like, that's within what, a few days?
Yes. It was 4 days after the mask mandate lifted. I had my first person walk in without a mask and didn't have one at all.
What do you tell them? What's that interaction like?
So in this instance, I asked the person to wait outside. It is sub below zero right now in Iowa, so it seems a little unfair, but I have a sign, a very large sign that I just redid on my front door. So I tried to make it obvious, but I had him wait at the door, and he was picking up an item, and I brought it to him at the door.
But so I'm clear, you know, there's no mask mandate from the government, but you're allowed to run your shop how you want it, right?
Yes. Like,
you're still able to put that sign up in your window. So
yes.
I guess I'm just trying to understand why you would see this change overnight.
And it's not. The rule in my store is still that you have to wear a mask, but
right.
There is, I would say, a sense of entitlement that people have. Mm. If I don't want to wear one, I don't have to wear one, so I'm not going to wear one.
This is a joke. I haven't worn a mask ever. I go into some of my physical therapy and I tell them, I'm sorry, I'm not wearing a mask.
One of my staff is 19 and that's a difficult ask to ask maybe a grown man or someone 20, 30 years older than them to put a mask on and the fear of interaction that could happen. You know, she's still learning kind of this customer service role. It's a lot of pressure for her. She may be working by herself. I don't think people understand that it's kind of a snowball. You know, it goes downhill when you don't care about other people because you don't want to follow a policy that someone might have. It affects us down the hill.
Hmm. But then here's my question, because like, as we speak, we're clearly at a better place than we were in November or December, right? Like,
correct.
There are more at-risk people getting vaccinated. Obviously, there's not as much COVID flying around in Des Moines. At what point would you feel safe? Like, what are the parameters you would like to be in place?
Can you give us your assessment of some of the states that have begun to relax their protocols? For example, Iowa among those who have.
I would love for us to just be following the CDC guidelines because I feel like those are the people that are put in place to assist us with these types of things. I am not a medical expert and I don't pretend to be. So I put a lot of faith and value in people who are smarter than me.
I would just simply discourage any of those activities. We really need to keep all of the mitigation measures at play here. If we're really
unfortunately, the people in Iowa who are making these decisions are not medical professionals. So going against their advice seems dangerous to me. It seems like a bad move and sets a bad precedent, in my opinion.
And correct me if I'm wrong. I think, you know, the governor, Kim Reynolds, she rescinds the mask mandate. But then the leaders of Des Moines and the county there say, well, then we're going to put our own mask mandate in. So, I mean, there are technically still rules about this. Are you seeing that those are followed or not? Or what do people do?
Absolutely. So I'm in a historic district, a shopping district. There's a lot of stores on my street. And the general vibe down here is that we're all requiring masks. So that's been really nice to know that the whole neighborhood is on board. And you're not going to walk into one store with a different set of rules and a different store with a different set of rules. And I know there are stores that have ran into people who disagree with their policy and they've dealt with it the best they can. And it's not really fair that we have to do that, but it is what it is.
All right, that is Becky Pospisil there at The Naughty Nail, the name of her store there in Des Moines, Iowa. Becky, thank you so much for the perspective.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I Next up on Start Here, don't tell them about Biden their time. Why asylum seekers in Mexico say a new administration has still left them out in the cold. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
With the end of an impeachment trial of a former president, you could argue that yesterday, on President's Day of all days, was really the true beginning of the Biden era. That at least in the public consciousness, the spotlight is finally solely on him, which can be great or not so great.
The White House is also pushing for those $1,400 stimulus checks. Republicans want those to be at about $1,000 and more targeted toward lower income families.
It means that Joe Biden is about to use his bully pulpit to start pushing through ambitious, expensive relief plans. It also means all the attention is on him when something like this happens.
The massive migrant caravan trying to head to the U.S. New video showing thousands of migrants rushing barriers.
Remember, it used to be if you came to the U.S., if you're on American soil, you can say, I'm claiming asylum status. I'm in danger in my country. I need to live here now for my safety. And while you waited to plead that case officially, you stayed in the U.S. Sometimes you were in detention. Sometimes you could stay with a family member. The point is you were here.
We're not letting them in, but they're trying to flood our country.
In the Trump era, the Department of Homeland Security instituted a policy where if you came through Mexico to apply for asylum in the States, well, great, but you have to wait for your hearing in Mexico. That was 2 years ago. There are still people sitting there waiting in tents while, yes, an historic cold streak whips through their camps. ABC's Ignacio Torres has been covering the crisis at the border. Ignacio, what are you seeing this week?
Brad, this week I started getting phone calls from a couple of migrants who are on the other side of the U.S.-Mexico border in a camp located in Matamoros, Mexico. This is on the other side of the Texas border. And I started hearing that they were waking up to tents that were practically frozen. The conditions have gotten so severe. It's gotten so cold. It's even snowing in this part of the region that hasn't seen snow. And we're talking about migrants who traveled from Central America and have made their way up to the U.S.-Mexico border.
The biggest loophole drawing illegal aliens to our borders is the use of fraudulent or meritless asylum claims to gain entry.
Now, after the Trump administration have been asked and forced to stay on the Mexico side while their asylum cases are being heard.
Tens of thousands have been sent back where they have no choice but to live in these makeshift camps. Many are subjected to kidnapping, assault, extortion, even death.
They're faced with a condition of dealing with COVID, dealing with changing policies, and now dealing with severe weather conditions. A lot of these migrants are even seeing snow for the very first time.
But wait, Ignacio, like, I thought, you know, the Biden administration took over almost a month ago. They did not like this policy, this idea that you had to stay in Mexico while you waited. I thought, like, they were saying they were rolling this back, right? What's been happening?
And you're right, Brett. They don't like it. And what they're doing is they're pausing it at the moment.
I'm not making new law. I'm eliminating bad policy.
They want to slowly start allowing the thousands of people that have been forced to wait on the Mexico side to finally start making their claims and come into the country. We're talking about asylum seekers here.
This comes as the number of people captured at the border has been increasing in recent months. Last month, averaging 3,000 per day, up more than double from this time last year.
And what the Biden administration has said is that this Friday, February 19th, they're going to start phase one. This means that they want to target about 25,000 migrants who have been forced to wait on the Mexico side to finally make their claims and slowly start letting them into the country.
In all, three ports of entry will be involved in the reprocessing. One in California, one in El Paso, and third in Brownsville. Each expected to handle about 100 people a day.
But keep in mind, we're living in COVID times at the moment. It's not going to be so easy. Mm. And what they're going to have to do is start creating a process where they have to get COVID tested on the Mexico side before they can even come into the country and make their claim, and then eventually start the process of asylum.
We're going to work to undo the moral and national shame of the previous administration that literally, not figuratively, ripped children from the arms of their families, their mothers and fathers at the border.
Well, so then if you're the Biden administration, Ignacio, you're basically saying, hey, we got this huge backlog that's developed over the last 2 years. We're going to start by taking like 300 people at a time. But which 300? Like, is it whoever was just there first? Is it someone with a medical condition? Like, who's going when?
And that's been the question that a lot of the migrants have in these camps.
Migrants like Josue Cornejo at the migrant camp in Matamoros say he's confused after learning some recently arrived migrants to the border are not being returned to Mexico. This happening while his family continues to live in the migrant camp for over a year.
The policy has changed so many times that at this point, they don't know when it's going to start, how it's going to work. And when they're having to deal with freezing conditions in a tent, that's almost in the back of their mind. They're desperate to get the process started.
This news should not be interpreted as an opening for people to migrate irregularly to the United States. Only eligible individuals will be allowed to enter through designated ports of entry.
But at the same time, the Biden administration has been very careful in making sure that they're not creating a situation where people will flood a port of entry and make their asylum claim.
Yeah, and so the scramble, this kind of bureaucratic scramble is on right now to figure out what to do next, knowing that literal lives are on the line, perhaps. Ignacio Torres, thanks so much for keeping track of it.
Thank you, Brad.
And one last thing. Today is not just any Tuesday, it's Fat Tuesday.
How did I guess I'm going to be? Because I'm cute.
In a normal year, Mardi Gras brings an estimated $1 billion in economic activity just to the city of New Orleans.
Daytime parades, people would have crawfish boils.
That's Mariana Boyd, who's lived in the city most of her life, and she described what a parade now looks like in the COVID era.
Now there's really not much of that, but we do have awesome house floats.
Yeah, house floats. You might have heard of this. They're calling it Yardi Gras, meaning floats this year are stationary and you just drive around to look at them.
Oh, I love all the food-themed ones. Like, there's one around the corner from my house that's cannoli-themed.
A circus. You have the circus animals, the popcorn.
It celebrates, well, the important healthcare workers and all the nurses that took care of us.
And lots of neighborhoods around the country have had to rewrite traditions over the last year. Lots of neighbors have spruced up their houses to make everyone feel better. The difference here is you're living in a land of professional float artists.
They take their houses and then they pay the float designers and decorators who would normally do the floats for Mardi Gras parades.
I've made more money in 6 weeks than I did all year.
I've talked to some float artists who say they're already getting jobs for next year.
Oh, I figured people were just doing it themselves, because you're saying this is way more than, you know, a funky paint job or something.
Well, some people are. Some people are DIY, which is totally cool.
There's a lot you can do with spray paint and plywood.
Some people are doing it to throw some money towards people who are essentially out of jobs.
Which is why, as you drive through New Orleans today, you're liable to see dinosaurs prowling through one yard and an octopus exploding out of the windows of another.
I just got off the streetcar immediately when I saw Dolly. She's my favorite.
It's also a chance for New Orleans to reclaim its rep in some ways. Last year, we already knew COVID-19 was in the States when NOLA decided to move forward with celebrations in the French Quarter.
Just 4 weeks ago, the entire city of New Orleans and thousands of tourists celebrating Mardi Gras.
We now have 1,795 cases in the state of Louisiana and 65 deaths.
Some residents feel like they were judged through the lens of hindsight weeks later.
There was never any hint from anyone to me or to the mayor of New Orleans that there should be any consideration to downsizing or canceling Mardi Gras.
Perhaps singled out unfairly, since it's way easier to wag your finger at young people drinking while others are still going to NBA games and St. Patrick's Day gatherings.
and it's all the bon temps roulé. You know, we let the good times roll, baby.
But after being hit especially hard by the pandemic, New Orleans decided to reshape what a party town can look like, even on a way skinnier budget.
I don't know. I might put my one-year-old in a box and decorate it and pretend we're at a parade. I don't know. Have her throw some beads, something like that.
I can't wait to see that. All right. Mariana, thanks so much for being with us. Good luck.
Thank you so much, Brad. Happy Mardi Gras.
Plus, literally too cold to party in Louisiana. Like, just make a king cake, stay inside, enjoy yourself. Start here tomorrow. Hit subscribe if you haven't already. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.